From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're here, and our connection this hour is made in a beehive, a hive of honeybees in particular, that is being attacked by Asian giant hornets. We've come to know the hornets as murder hornets. It's not a very nice term for them. And over many years, the hornets have made meals of entire colonies of honeybees. But as time has gone on, something interesting has happened. The honeybees have found ways to smother the attackers, a kind of defense mechanism that is impressive and effective. Now, honeybees don't learn this technique in classrooms or defense training exercises. So how do they know what to do? Can we consider the bees intelligent? Let's shift to a forest. Recently on Connections, we welcomed the researcher and author Suzanne Simard, explaining how forests have demonstrated a kind of intelligence through their root systems. They can share and balance necessary resources for survival. When threats emerge, they have devised a kind of warning system among the trees. Does that mean the trees are intelligent? Is that the right word for it? Certainly the forest system is learning and adapting. All of that is mind-blowing enough, but let's broaden out to look at entire planets. Writing in The Atlantic, three authors are asking the question, can a planet have a mind of its own? One of the authors is a frequent guest on this program, astrophysicist Adam Frank, and the authors acknowledge that some listeners might hear this question and decide it's a little bit of New Age woo here, but they offer a cogent explanation for the utility of even asking. They write, quote, making sense of how a planet's intelligence might be defined and understood helps shine a little light on humanity's future on this planet, or lack thereof, end quote. So is it possible to quantify or study a planet's intelligence? The authors write, quote, going so far as to account for the collective intelligence of all life on the planet is, admittedly, an audacious concept. But over the past couple of years, we decided to give it a shot. Our work has been a thought experiment, one that plays with ideas that science understands but extends them to confront a stark reality. Humanity stands at a most precipitous moment in both our and our planet's evolution. We have discovered that the universe is teeming with worlds, many of which might host life and even intelligence. At the same time, our own world is in peril, caught in a climate crisis brought on by our supposed advancement as a civilization. End quote. So, what does this mean for us? Where do we go from here? And what does the collective intelligence of this planet mean in this big question? Our guests are here to talk about it. Adam Frank is the Helen F. and Fred H. Gowan Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Rochester, author of numerous books, including Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds, and The Fate of the Earth. Welcome back to the program.
As always, it's a great pleasure.
Great pleasure to have you. And David Grinspoon is with us, a senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute, author of books including Earth in Human Hands, Shaping Our Planet's Future. Both of the books I just mentioned, by the way, highly recommend. They should be in every classroom, and they should be on your shelf. David, welcome back to the program. Good to have you.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's great to have the opportunity to talk with you.
And both of our guests are Carl Sagan medalists, though Adam Frank was a bronze medalist.
That's right. And he was a gold man.
David David was a gold. Adam, by a hundredth of a second, bronze. No, Carl Sagan medalist. What does that mean, Adam Frank?
Well, first of all, it means we both get actual, like,
the
medals.
Real medals.
That you can wear around your neck, like Flavor Flav. I want to wear mine all the time. you know, it's for outreach. It's recognition of our – and David won his, you know, 2004, I believe. Isn't that right, David?
2006.
So he was way ahead of me.
It's cool. It's cool because it's recognition of a working scientist, but specifically for work in communication, which is not something that, you know, we always get recognized by our professional peers for. So it's really a nice thing.
Well, it's great to have both of our guests here. And they have a third co-author, I should say, this Atlantic piece, which we will link to. It's a really interesting read. Your other co-author is who?
Sarah Walker at Arizona State University. She's a, you know, really, really interesting, brilliant scientist, you know, astrophysicist, astrobiologist.
It's great to have David and Adam and Sarah's work, their collective work, you can find on our platforms. That's the basis for this conversation. I started by mentioning whether it's a colony of honeybees that have figured out over time how to survive an attack by a predator that has been wiping out their species, or the forests sharing through their root systems the resources that start to look like the trees are almost talking to each other. Those are sort of the microcosm, and the macro side of this is, are planets doing that? Let's start with a question on what this actually means. How do we define planetary intelligence? I was thinking, reading your piece, Adam, of Jeff Goldblum's favorite famous quote in Jurassic Park, life finds a way. It's, right. It's kind of what we're talking about, right?
What we're talking about, that's it. I mean, it's the idea that over the course of evolution, of the evolution of the biosphere, the unit that you want to think about in the evolution of life on the planet is not the species, but is, you know, the environment, and that you can't separate those two, and that the proper scale to think about this is a planetary scale. So with forests, I mean, the forests, that I think they're called mycozoarial networks, yep, the fungal networks. You know, that research is stunning, and it shows that, you know, these forests that are literally hundreds and hundreds of miles across are acting like an entity, like a single entity. So it's not the tree that is the living thing. It's the forest, and the trees are like the cells, you know, in the body of the forest. So if you can get collective intelligence acting on, you know, scales of hundreds of miles, why not on scales of the entire planet?
Okay, and what's the utility of even pondering this, Adam?
Well, there's a bunch. I mean, so there were three things that we were looking at. There were three reasons why we thought this idea could be useful. The first is understanding the 4.5 billion year history of the Earth with its 3.5 at least billion year history of life and the changes. Understanding how life kind of hijacked the planet. And this goes to the idea of, well, this is the idea of the biosphere, which is really a relatively new concept, you know, only 100 years old or so. And then there's the Gaia theory that's also part of that. So that's idea one, the history of life on Earth. Idea two is what's happening to us now, right? The Anthropocene, this climate crisis that we're in, which really could take human civilization down. There's no doubt that it could. Humans aren't going to go extinct, but whether or not this kind of civilization can continue is up for grabs. And then finally, what we call techno-signatures, what we used to call SETI, the search for other life in the universe, and particularly technological civilizations, because what we're trying to identify is what has to happen for a technological civilization in order for it to become long-lived. And the civilizations you are going to detect with your new telescopes are going to be the long-lived ones.
David, how do you describe the utility here? You want to add to what you just heard?
Yeah, no, that's a great summary Adam just offered. I would say one of the useful things about this, you know, both fun and hopefully useful, is it gets you to think about the question of what is intelligence in a new way. Like you said in your introduction, it can sort of sound woo to say, oh, the planet is thinking or, you know, acting intelligently. But if you really think about, you know, it forces you to ask, what are the qualities of an organism that makes us say that it's exhibiting intelligence? And then can we detect aspects of those qualities at a global scale? So you could say something like, if an organism is sensing its environment, getting information about its environment, and then acting on that information to defend itself in some way, then that's a form of intelligence. And then you can look at the planet and look at, for instance, the ozone, the problem with the ozone layer. One way of looking at that is Earth detected that there was a harm, gathered information, and then there were a series of interactions of the parts of, you know, the global system. And then out of those interactions came a behavior to change, you know, to defend itself against the threatening information. So in some sense, that's an example of the planet acting as a global intelligence. And we wanted to explore whether that was something that you could look at in an evolutionary sense, both to understand ourselves and the way we're acting on the planet in a new way. And then, as Adam suggested, also to think about the larger implications of that for possible planets in the universe that may be learning to act intelligently.
So there's essentially four points of evolutionary interest here for a planet laid out. And I want to touch on these terms, and then we're going to get into, I'm going to read a passage from their piece that I just found amazing. Before we do that, though, how's that for a tease? Is that good?
That sounds good.
That's good.
Can I add something?
Yeah,
Because we also want to, you know, when we think about intelligence, we have this idea of, you know, like what's on our heads with our thoughts of like, well, tomorrow I'm going to do this and today I'm going to.
Right.
But what we were really thinking about here was the idea of cognition. You know, a cognitive system is one which responds to the, you know, senses the environment and then responds to the environment in ways. And what we were particularly interested, one of the most important ideas here is the idea of self-maintenance and self-production, because that's really a hallmark of life. Every from the tiniest cell, the ability to, you know, draw from the environment information to allow itself to continue. Because, you know, the weird thing about life is you can't turn it off. Like, there's no on and off switch. There's dead and the end. But, you know, so life constantly has to maintain itself by seeing what's happening in the environment and then responding to it. And we were asking whether that kind of, like, cognitive activity could happen on planetary scales. It's clear it can happen in hives, which can extend across meters. It's clear now we're learning it can happen in forests, which can extend across hundreds of miles. So can it happen across a planet entire?
I think the trees aspect of this is what is going to get more people to really believe it, because human beings, I think, are conditioned to think, well, plants are just plants.
Right.
But plants don't have a brain. Plants are not thinking, but they are responding to inputs right. in the environment, and they are sometimes working systematically and collectively to respond in amazing ways. Again, just read Suzanne Simard's book for listeners who haven't picked it up yet, and there's so much out there that details how this is happening. Again, it's not like there's like some sort of collective mind and the plant woke up going, what are we going to do today?
Right, I'm bored.
After coffee, I'm going to talk to the bees. And like, no, but the response to the input here is what we're talking about. And how we get there in terms of what state a planet's in. Well, there's the immature biosphere, the mature biosphere, then an immature technosphere, which is kind of where we are mm-hmm. now, mm-hmm. and then maybe the mature technosphere.
That's where we got to go.
That's where we got to go if we're going to be successful, if the Earth is going to be sort of happy, healthy, and we're not going to sort of not be able to have the civilization that we want, right?
Right.
Okay. So can I ask both of you kind of just take us through the terms here? Immature biosphere. I'll start with Adam Frank.
Okay. So the immature biosphere takes us back to the early evolution of the Earth. You know, at first, Earth was just a molten rock, like literally they're what they call the magma ocean from all the impacts and everything. You know, and then eventually the surface cooled and you get this period called the Hadean. Hadean because the first part was so hot and, you know, hell-like. But that's when life starts. And during the arc, there's a Hadean, and then there's also what's called the Archean, and this is when you know, these are eons, these are billions of years or a billion years, so, but life was just getting started. And the important thing about life was, when we talk about life, we have lots of it's all microbial. And the microbial colonies hadn't yet hijacked the planet in terms of changing its atmosphere, in terms of being able to cycle nutrients through and reuse them. You know, their activity hadn't yet really affected the other planetary systems. By that, I mean the atmosphere, the hydrosphere, the water, the cryosphere, the ice, and the lithosphere, which is the land. Like, those systems were still kind of operating on their own. And what we're going to see, and David can pick up when we get to the mature biosphere, is that eventually life gets so powerful that it starts affecting, it hijacks those other systems.
Okay. David, you want to add to that?
Yeah, that's a great description of the immature biosphere. You know, it's just organisms acting in their own environment. Life, in that sense, is more of a localized phenomenon. Even if it started to spread globally, it's not having global effects or really, we could even say, global control. And then what happens when the transition is made to what we call the mature biosphere is that life starts to have global consequences, and then those global consequences become embedded in the way life interacts with the planet. So, you know, the sort of best example of this, and one that we draw upon a lot, is what happens with oxygen, where life discovers photosynthesis, great energy source, powering itself from the local star, probably something that happens throughout the universe because it's such an obvious energy source. And then that starts to change the atmosphere. You're starting to liberate oxygen. And then that really changes the planet and starts to affect really everything about the planet, the atmosphere, the minerals, the global cycles, even plate tectonics starts to become affected by the influence of life. And at that point, then life is sort of embedded in the operation of the planet, where there are feedbacks between life and between the, you know, the quote, non-living parts of the planet, the physical evolution of the planet, where you start to develop, you know, what is really called, you know, the biosphere. Well, we're making the distinction to the mature biosphere, where the cycles of life are deeply embedded and deeply implicated in the cyclic functioning of the planet.
So that takes us through the mature biosphere. And in the 1960s, the scientist Frank Drake came up with an equation that helped him at least decide that maybe in our own galaxy there's 10,000 technological advanced civilizations. That was an old number based on rudimentary numbers. And over the decades, we learned a lot more about how many stars have planets. We can assume that every star we see has at least one. Some of them have three or four. Some have a collection like ours. Many, many more than we thought. And the new equation that Adam Frank and Woody Harrelson. Congratulations. It was Woody Guthrie.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
So Adam Frank and colleagues created a new equation and said, essentially, from what we know about the universe, the odds of us being alone now or ever as a technological civilization are 1 in 10 billion trillion. So probably not. What we are talking about this hour, I think David just touched on it, Adam, this evolution from immature biosphere, mature biosphere, and then immature technosphere, and maybe mature technosphere, same kind of progression we would see in a lot of different planets throughout our universe, right?
Possibly, yes. So the mature biosphere part, you don't need an industrial civilization, right? I think we have to be careful when we should stop using intelligent, because now we're seeing intelligence. That's kind of our argument. You know, there's lots of ways to think about intelligence. But technological, large-scale harvesting of energy for building stuff,
a cinch.
Yeah, that's not a cinch. And we don't know how rare that's going to be. But if it happens, what we're trying to lay out is there's a pitfall there that happens, which is what we're in. So the important thing about the mature biosphere, this goes to what was called the Gaia hypothesis, or the Gaia theory that James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis came up with, was the idea that the biosphere was like super dense with feedback loops. Like, you know, this microbe would produce that gas, but this other microbe would eat that gas, and then the third microbe would emit another gas, which changed like how much sunlight got reflected. And so the whole thing was the biosphere was this dense network of feedback loops, which together kind of kept the planet habitable. As the sun sun continually gets hotter slowly. And what was happening, the biosphere kind of adapted to that by, you know, dumping more of this kind of gas, which cools the planet, etc. So the biosphere has all of these feedback loops, which create the self-maintenance and the self-production of the biosphere. So that's what we mean by planetary intelligence, right? So the mature biosphere has lots of planetary intelligence. The technosphere is what we've been building, right? And by the technosphere, we mean not only like, you know, the buildings, but we also mean the technosphere includes all of the transportation networks, the financial networks, the energy networks, all the ways we move stuff around, including our ideas about them as well, the bureaucratic, processes we put in place to manage it all. And in some sense, you should think of the technosphere as almost being a little bit independent of us. Like, we built it, but it kind of runs on its own in a weird way, or it just continues running in spite of the individual actions of any one of us, right? So the problem is our technosphere is not the one we've built is not self-producing and self-maintaining. In fact, actually, it's degrading the possibilities of its own continued existence.
Can I read from your piece now? I love this passage. Quote, in its scale and complexity, the technosphere is almost as awesome to contemplate as the biosphere. But everything rides on that word almost. That's because our technosphere is still immature. The biosphere became mature when it integrated into the other planetary systems in such a way that, at the very least, it didn't actively degrade the Earth's habitability. But our current version of the technosphere has it all backwards. It's not integrated into the other Earth systems. It simply draws matter and energy from them. Our technosphere is, in the long run, working against itself. It's formally stupid. It leaves the entire planet unguided, careening into new and uncharted territory. This is not self-maintenance and self-production. It is not a state of planetary intelligence. What Earth needs is a mature technosphere. This would be a technosphere rooted in the biosphere, which itself is rooted in the other planetary systems. A technosphere that self-maintains the entire Earth system. Only this would make Earth fully intelligent, because as far as we can tell, it's what has to happen for our civilization to sustain itself on the planet in the long term. End quote. Okay, so I read this. I think I understood it. So I'm going to ask both of you, how do we go from this dumb technosphere that is just kind of harvesting energy for our own sort of dumb, clumsy wants and needs, and going against the idea of creating a system that is self-sustaining, that honors life and habitability, that doesn't lead to mass extinctions of many species and opportunity to live? How do we get in a technological world that doesn't eventually erase us? I'll start with Adam.
So the answer is your technosphere, which I said is like these technological systems, but it's also the bureaucratic systems. It's the financial systems. So my daughter now works in climate policy, and it's really interesting. I mean, she is in the weeds on this stuff. Like, she's right now working on, sort of how carbon offsets work. You know, when the airlines say like, oh, yeah, every time you fly, we plant a bunch of trees. Turns out a lot of that is crap. Like, they're counting the same tree 58 times. So just like cells had to develop these like unbelievably complicated molecular metabolism processes that eventually contributed to the self-maintenance and the feedbacks in the biosphere, it's on that level that we're going to build thousands and thousands of feedback loops into the technosphere. For example, right now, if you want to go, if you're an investment bank and you want to fund, somebody comes to you and says, "Hey, we want to fund a new coal plant in India," you're like, "Oh yeah, sure," or "I'll find you somebody who will." As opposed to the system being like, no, we just don't do that. Like, the financial system no longer funds fossil fuels. That's like one of the most simple things. That there's just like I don't know what horrible example I could come up with, but I probably couldn't get an investment bank to fund, imagine the worst nightmare scenario, right? Of something from a horror movie. Like, the bank investment bank would be like, "Oh my God, we don't do that." You would have to say that, like, in the future, there are feedback loops to the whole system
that prevent that?
That would basically say, yeah, investment banks, we don't do fossil, we don't do coal plants.
But this is where like my small brain is struggling, because my brain is thinking, well, that's still just us. That's not the planet. We have to decide. The planet has to deal with our decisions. You seem to be saying, look, we're all part of it now. It's all part of the system. What we need is inertia that takes us in a direction that doesn't destroy and degrade the climate and habitability, but is sort of self-protecting, that isn't...
Well, inertia, think about the financial system. The financial system we have was built over the last 200 years. There's all kinds of inertia built into it about the different kinds of banks, how the rules and the laws that set those banks up, the rules and the laws that allows the bank to talk to each other. Look at the SWIFT, right? Right now, yeah. We're all talking about, that thing took a long time to build, right? You could build into that something that, you can imagine there's feedback loops in that just don't allow certain kinds of activity that will harm the technosphere by harming the biosphere by harming the other systems.
David, add to this,
yeah,
please.
Well, yeah, I think that it's the concept of feedback is really important, and not just feedback, but positive as opposed to negative feedback. One thing that distinguishes the mature biosphere from the immature biosphere is that there are a lot of negative feedbacks, meaning if the system starts to get out of whack in one direction, there are mechanisms that pull it back into some kind of equilibrium. And the analogy then to the developing a mature technosphere from an immature technosphere is to develop those feedback loops where if the system starts to get out of whack, like say with, carbon in the atmosphere, to use sort of the most pressing current example, then there are mechanisms built into place, negative feedbacks, which pull it back into place. And, you said, well, so it's just human beings doing things. But actually, I think you can make the case that it's not just individual human beings. A big part of this is that we're developing, the planet, in a sense, is developing the sensory apparatus to understand what's happening. Think of the network of satellites in orbit, Earth observing satellites. You can look at that as a new kind of sensory organ where the planet is looking down on itself and going, oh, these gases are out of balance, and that's not good for my survival in the long run. What am I going to do about it? And it's interesting because then you can bring it down to individual human beings and their conversations and their actions. But what we're saying is that there's a level of analysis where you can look at the whole system and say, here's the sensory apparatus in orbit. Here are these feedbacks that are happening between behavior and consequence. And in a sense, it's the development of an awareness of consequence. which is why we also love using the word mature for mature technosphere, because by analogy, an individual becomes mature when it becomes aware of the consequences of its actions. And building in that awareness is the same as building in a kind of negative feedback where you develop that rudimentary, the system develops that rudimentary ability to say, oh, this is taking me in a direction that's not good for my health and my survival. I'm going to act counter to that and prevent it. And even on that basic level of that negative feedback, that's developing a kind of awareness, a kind of, we like to say, maturity in the technosphere that points the way towards a more sustainable, functional global civilization.
I do want to make one important distinction, just in case anybody is hearing this and thinking about the ways that a planet in its maturation can become better at dealing with inputs, more self-sustaining. This is not a free pass for us to do whatever we want, thinking the planet will figure it out. And I think there are too many people who... So here's an example. I heard Rush Limbaugh years ago. Yes, I've listened to Rush when he was alive. I listen to everybody. I want to know what people are saying. Limbaugh said years ago, when we really run out of fossil fuels, we will figure out alternative energies because we are very innovative and we will have to. But we've got plenty of fossil fuels for now. We'll figure it out. And he went on to say, if the planet's really having a problem with it, it'll let us know. But it turns out the planet has been letting us know, and we've been denying that what we are experiencing is a result of those decisions. Yeah. And so what David and Adam and Sarah have done for us is not give us, I don't think, a free pass to say, hey, don't worry, as our planet continues to mature, eventually it will self-regulate, and whatever we throw at it, it will just balance it out. Adam, can you start with that?
Yeah, yeah, because the problem here is not as we've talked about many times in the show, the problem is not the biosphere. Like, no matter what, the biosphere is going to be fine. It's going to end up being a different biosphere. It's the technosphere. Like, if we continue on this road, the thing we call the technosphere that we all rely on for our food every day is what's going to collapse and no longer. And then, you know,
we'll go back to a biosphere.
We'll go back to write a biosphere. And because the biosphere will adapt, it'll do fine, but it just will take us out of the picture. It'll take whatever we've given it, move on with the, you know, new adaptations, but will leave us behind. And that's why, really, folks, my daughter has taught me so much, because it's about putting all these feedbacks in place, building literal feedbacks into the sense of, like, you know, your energy system doesn't literally have, with maybe artificial intelligence, won't allow certain things to happen, but also these bureaucratic systems. There's a 10,000 places that individuals working in climate change policy and are going to have to build these feedbacks into the whole system. And so that's why it's not just the technology, it's also the thought. Vladimir Vernadsky, the Russian scientist who came up with the idea of the biosphere, also had this term, the nosphere, which was the idea that the Earth will someday become covered in thought. And that's true. That's what we've developed. Look at the internet. And that the nosphere was this, you know, web of thinking. And that's really what we mean by the bureaucratic, or whatever you want to call it, the thinking parts of the technosphere. It's all the ways we're going to build the system and how it functions.
Vernadsky's.
Yeah, I would add that I think it's a great question you asked, Evan. And yeah. I would say that actually it's almost the opposite of that, the Rush Limbaugh point there, because what this really is about is as an acceptance of responsibility. Mm-hmm. It's trying to see clearly the role that we're in. And it's true. Ultimately, if we just use all the fossil fuels, you know, the world will keep going and something else will happen, but at tremendous cost and after tremendous suffering. And the idea is, if we want to continue to make the transition from an immature to a mature technosphere, then it's up to us to implement those feedbacks and to create those mechanisms so that we don't do things the hard way. We could burn all the fossil fuels, and sure, eventually there'll be a feedback, but there'll be so much unnecessary pain and suffering. Whereas if we see clearly what's happening here, we can say, well, these are the mechanisms we need now. And in fact, we're already developing those mechanisms. Let's hasten those kinds of bureaucratic feedbacks and other mechanisms that Adam's been talking about so that we don't do things the hard way.
That's great. The piece they wrote is so good, listeners. You got to check it out. Again, we're going to link on our platform so you can read the piece in The Atlantic, which has a really slick illustration, too. It's essentially asking whether planets like ours can have a mind of their own. And our guests, David Grinspoon, Adam Frank, are co-authors of that piece and some of this work that they're talking about. They cite in their piece Vernadsky, who is a name that I had not heard, but you sent me down the rabbit hole on Vernadsky, which is great. Don't you? The best writing is hard to get through because you're learning new things, and then now I'm going to go look this up.
Google.
Now I'm going to look this up. Yeah.
Google.
It's a perfect example. It's a really wonderful piece. Let's get some feedback from listeners. Let me start with Chris, I think, first. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. Chris is on. That's Joanne. Chris, I'll get you in a second. Hi. I think we got Joanne. Hi, Joanne. Hi. Go ahead.
Hi. So I called once before when Adam Brink was on, and I have to, first of all, thank you, Adam, for your programming. And secondly, say that I had called to say that I wanted to praise Adam for his writing, and I never actually praised him. I just said I was going to. So this time I am actually going to say that, you know, I really appreciate your provocative thoughts, and I'll extend that to David as well and your colleague, Sarah. And this is like totally mind blowing to me. My background's in biology, and I have been like sort of observing, you know, at a really small scale, maybe like similar thoughts, and like in the sense of there's this like force of community, even just everywhere you look among life systems, and I love this idea of the technosphere rooted in mature biosphere. Mm-hmm. It seems to me like deep wisdom, right? Like human beings. So humans are made up of as many non-human microbial cells as there are human cells. Like half of what we think of as ourselves is not us. Like it's literally not us. It's other little microbes and organisms. So like we are actually a community of stuff, and we go around thinking about tomorrow and all those things that our kind of like stupid intelligence of like what to eat and what to do every day and like, you know, what to collect in our houses and all that kind of garbage. But I mean, what to eat is actually kind of important. So
right.
Out of the picture. But my point is that, you know, and you get to a level, you know, of human intelligence where you realize like there's with maturity, sort of like along the same scale, I guess, of this like planetary movement as well, like that we are not just what we think of, you know, as ourselves, and that there's this bigger picture, right? And that so I think, yeah, human consciousness needs to move to sort of a wiser place where, yeah, the technosphere is rooted in a mature biosphere where we all realize that it's community from literally ourselves.
Yeah, it's interconnected.
Up to this giant, you know, planet.
Yeah, that's really what it is. It's about the communities. Thank you so much. That's a lovely, lovely comment. And it's a perfect observation. You can see this every walk in the park, you know, you can see this, that these, you know, the whole planet is nothing but interlocking, radiating communities of cooperation. And somehow over the last couple of years, you know, 100 years, I mean, I love science, but I think there was a big mistake that science made in sort of thinking that there was this reduction you could make, like, oh, it's just atoms, you know, and life is not really.
We can dominate it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And so really, but that's, you know, in some sense, you've got to see community, you know, life as being, you know, this very special thing that really can change its environments. And it's always communities of life. It's not individuals. It's communities.
Yeah. And by the way, Joanne, I try to get Adam Frank on this program more often. You would not believe off air what a diva he is. Whereas David Grinspoon is just a prince. Like, whatever you ask, the guy's like, yes.
I'm like, I have to check my schedule. I'm getting a massage this week. I'm sorry.
Yeah, right. David,
I just wanted to add.
Yeah, go ahead, David.
I love that comment. I just wanted to add a quote from Lynn Margulis, who we mentioned earlier, who one thing Lynn said that I love was, you have never been individuals.
Right. Right.
And that's hard for people to hear, I think, because I respect the desire to see a society that allows for individual thriving, rugged individualism, all of that. I mean, I get that. I understand the ethos. But you can't see it so religiously that you see yourself not as part of a community in just about every sense.
Well, being an individual also comes responsibilities, right? That's what people sort of want, half and not the other part. Mm. And to be, you are a community. There's no way to pretend that you're not part of a community. I'm really into, you know, hiking and what's called bushcraft. And sometimes I watch these videos and these guys are like, oh, I'm going to be out there all by myself. And it's just, and it's like, what, dude? Like, that's not impossible. Human beings always have been part of communities. And now what we see is that even human communities are embedded in this billion-year-old biosphere, and there's no separation.
I don't know what we're trying to prove to ourselves in those moments, you know. It's very interesting. But I will say I agree with Joanne that the piece that we're talking about this hour wasn't sort of an aha moment to me. I mean, it builds a lot on what David and Adam and their colleagues have been doing for years. But to put it in this sense, that planets go from immature biosphere to mature biosphere, and for those that become technological, it almost always starts with immature technosphere. And the question becomes, can you figure out how to get to mature technosphere where you are not eroding and degrading the ability of habitability? Otherwise, are we going to go backwards? Are we going and the planet will be here and will we not? It's just a wonderful way to think about it. Let me get back to your phone calls. This is Chris this time. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Yeah, I love your idea of the biosphere being the basis of a mature technosphere and the new feedback loops that would be part of that. And I'd say the indigenous people have been saying that forever, by saying that the Earth doesn't belong to us, we belong to the Earth. Problem is that I don't think that the powers that be, the profit-making, magnosphere, dominates our politics and our society. And environmental activists, just scream and tear their hair out that they're, it's like a juggernaut that we don't seem to be able to do anything about. And the smart money is really saying that it's already too late. So, that we're just heading for 2 degrees, which is going to kill us. And we're probably going to go up to 3 or 4. So I hate to be a downer. What you're saying is
it's only too late if you want a perfectly executed, perfectly mature, perfectly intelligent solution, because it's too late, to do things in the best way possible. But it's a fiction that it's too late to do anything. There's still a lot of room for action. The point here is that the more of this awareness of the problem that is spread, the more the systems naturally bend towards creating those negative feedbacks, including, say, capitalist systems, which you might say, that's all built on self-interest. But the fact is, look what's happening to solar and wind now. They're getting cheaper and cheaper. And the smart money, you could argue, is starting to move towards solutions which are compatible with a sustainable civilization. So it's sort of painfully slow, this maturation, but it's definitely not true that it's too late. It's just true that it's happening awfully slowly.
And it's also, right. I mean, it looks like we're going to overshoot, and we're going to have, the next century probably is going to be pretty bumpy. But you got to think long term, right? I mean, the biosphere took a long time. Because what I really think when I look at this, the next generation, the kids coming up now, they're just not going to tolerate what we've been tolerating. Like the idea that you can keep building coal fuel plants. They're just, they'll be out in the street because it's their world. I mean, so I think, we're in for a bumpy ride, and we're going to have to really be prepared for that. But, there's lots of things that we can do. And we're going to overshoot. But I think, these kinds of things I could be wrong, but we will, we're going to figure it out.
David, can I just follow up with you? I appreciate so much the way David Grinspoon just put it to Chris, whose call, by the way, I think was logical and totally fair. Mm-hmm. But David's point is one that I've not heard articulated in this way. It is only too late if the standard is the ideal. The ideal response to all of this, the maturation of our own awareness of what we were contributing in feedback loops and energy consumption. Yes, we've missed, probably missed that signpost and didn't make that
turn. I really appreciate Chris's point.
Yeah, but that's not the only standard here.
Yeah, I don't mean to dismiss it at all. You know, the situation is urgent, and we need to call as much attention to it as we can, and there's a lot that needs to be changed as quickly as can be changed. But I get a little bit upset when I hear people say that it's too late, because that can, you know, blend into a kind of nihilism, like, oh, we've blown it, there's nothing that can be done. And that is just so not true. There's a lot that can be done, and there's a lot that's being done. It's a matter of accelerating those transformations.
Well, let me get the other side of this idea. Richard says, techno schmeckno, what hubris. Technology is entirely responsible for the state of the planet. The only way for the Earth to survive and thrive is to rid itself of humans. We don't stand a chance of ever getting it right, even if we could agree and act together on it, which we never can. And maybe that's exactly what the Earth is doing, as it becomes less and less habitable for us. Kind of sad. Some of us are lovely creatures. That's from Richard. Adam, what would you say to
First
that?
Of all, I love the use of techno schmeckno. There you go. That's always a useful. So, you know, what can I say, Richard? I mean, that's a point of view, but I don't see any reason why you would take that point of view. I mean, look, you know, as I've always liked to point out, human beings are just the latest evolution, and our civilization is just the latest evolutionary innovation that the planet has come up with. It's been doing this for a long time, and, you know, there's nothing inherently evil about us. It wasn't like, you know, human beings arrived and you know, the Earth went like, oh my God, this is terrible.
Don't take our fossil fuels, and humans were like, ha ha ha.
Right.
We're going to dig that oil out of
here. Yeah, no, even when you think about as I've often pointed out, like when we discovered fossil fuels, it wasn't like because we were like, oh, I'm going to destroy the planet with this. It was like, oh, I can heat my house. This is awesome. Right. And it turned out that there were unintended consequences. And then once we realized those unintended consequences, you know, scientists started to make people aware. And then the people who had financial interests were like, oh, no, we're not doing anything about it. You know, those folks definitely are a problem. Right. Who purposely created misinformation. But the problem, the wonderful thing about science is that, you know, eventually you can only hide the truth for so long. And as we see, climate change is happening. So, yeah, I don't think there's any reason to say that somehow technological systems. I mean, do you think that's true for every planet in the universe? Is any place where there were technology, you know, these industrial processes that a civilization or that a species might figure out how to do, are they all doomed? Is it like, is there something bad about just technology? Are you saying it's just human beings who stink? Because sometimes we stink and sometimes we don't.
Yeah,
so let's make an argument for the schmeckno sphere here. Humans are not, first of all, humans are not the only species even on Earth that uses technology. We've taken it to a level. There are other tool making species, and it seems to be something that can happen in an evolutionary sense. We're the ones that have taken it to the point now where it's really affecting the planet, but what we have to ask is, and sure, our current the current state of our technological civilization is not admirable in ways that the questioner has, very vividly pointed out. But you have to ask, is there another way we can imagine interacting with the planet? Can we even imagine ways in which technology becomes a great defense to the planet? And, you know, one thing that we might point out is that the dinosaurs are no longer here because they did not have a space program. And the object that hit the Earth and wiped out the dinosaurs and most other species at that time, there are other objects like that. There are even bigger ones in the solar system. And it may be that in the long run, it's only technology that can ensure the continued survival of life on Earth. So, we've got some work to do for sure, but it's not obvious that technology ultimately isn't a force for good and for survival of the biosphere as a whole, and can even be a protector of the biosphere if applied with the kind of global scale awareness that we are trying to describe and advocate here.
I just want to note, this is why I love working with David. You know, is that so no, good. That's such a beautiful, it's such a beautiful point, and it's such a beautiful kind of counterpoint to that, like, you know, oh, human beings stink. It's like, well, right, in some sense, it may, well, just, I don't even repeat what David said. It's just like, but that's why I like working with him, because those kinds of, that perspective.
Brenda writes to say, fascinating stuff, wondering if your guests have read the new novel Termination Shock, which is a novel set in a near future Earth where climate change has significantly altered human society and follows attempts at a scheme that she doesn't want to give away. No, have not heard of that?
No,
David?
Not yet.
I haven't read it yet, but it's on my radar.
Okay, Termination Shock is recommended by
Thank
Brenda.
You.
On this one, different David, just writing in. Boy, there's so much feedback here. Look what you guys have done to me. I've lost track of all of it. Now I can't. The way my email threads is an indication we are still in the dumb technosphere. If my email is threaded differently, I could actually access what people are sending to me, and maybe we would be in the mature technosphere. But I can't. David, thank you for the email, which I've lost. We've got a few more minutes here, and I want to wrap the conversation in a way that isn't sort of fraudulently hopeful. But I do think, I want to build on the point that David Grinspoon made. When we think about 1 degree, 1.5, 2, 2.5, I think Adam said earlier, human beings are probably going to be here for a while. We're going to be hard to erase entirely as a species.
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
But it could get very, very rough and ugly, depending on what happens on this planet, and a very unpleasant place to be for humans. And there's a big difference between 4 degrees and 3 degrees and 2. I mean, they're all bad, but there's a big difference. And just because we missed the signpost that said, here's the ideal time to shift to solar and wind and all that stuff, doesn't mean that there is not a reason to try to create a mature technosphere. David Grinspoon, about a minute and a half. Just because we're not going to get that ideal, can we still achieve a mature technosphere in a warmed planet that makes it harder, that sees sea levels rise? Or is that a time where we go, well, we missed it, we're going to have to hang on in this dumb technosphere for a while?
No, I think there's every reason to believe that we can achieve it. Where I would say we're even on our way in the rudimentary steps of building it. It, to me, it's you know, like H.G. Wells used to talk about the race between education and catastrophe. It's like the sooner we can get along with the job of constructing it, the less pain and suffering there will be. I mean, I'm quite confident there will be a 22nd and a 23rd and a 24th century. The question is, what's the path there? We are going to be post-fossil fuels in, say, 100 years. And we'll look back at this time and say, oh, man, that was dumb. Why did we take so long? It's just, how are we getting from here to there? And hopefully these ideas are, you know, one small piece of the puzzle that help us to see ourselves in such a way that we realize that this is part of our role on this planet right now, is to facilitate the construction of what we call the mature technosphere, by which our awareness of the planet, our awareness of our own interactions with the planet, help to initiate a new phase where we're not fighting the planet, but working with it.
Adam Frank.
Yeah, I will just to build on that, you know, why we wrote this, why we wanted to think about it was, well, there were some real scientific questions that were of interest. But, you know, the story, you can only go forward when you have the right story to tell about going forward. You have to know where you're going in order to set, you know, set your set out in the journey. And so what we're trying to do is sort of, and this is what has to happen across the board. We have to have new stories about what we need to do and where we need to go. And they just haven't existed. Climate change is really a relatively new phenomena for us to encounter. Humanity has never encountered something like this before and has never had to act on this kind of planetary scale before. So literally we're inventing this as we go along. And so I wish we did have the ideal version, but that's not going to happen. Like I said, I think it's going to be kind of a bumpy ride. But, you know, there's already on multiple levels, from the technology to draw carbon out of the atmosphere to the sort of, you know, administrative, diplomatic, bureaucratic relationships that need to be forged. All of these things are, in fact, actually happening now. It's just going to be, you know, how hard it's going to be to get there.
But you don't seem to subscribe, much as I respect Richard's email, to the idea that humans bad and eventually Earth will kick us out.
I do not think there's anything guaranteed. I think there could be collapse. There could be, you know, long-tailed collapse. It could get bad. But I don't think – I really don't believe that's going to – honestly, in my soul, I don't believe that's going to happen. I do think the question is, how many years is it going to be bad? That's the question. How many years of suffering are we going to have to do before we get there? We want to make that as short as possible.
David and Adam and Sarah write in their piece, it might be a transition that any civilization anywhere in the galaxy must navigate if it wants to be around for a long time, end quote. It's the great filter that we've talked about, and this is just a sharper way of bringing it into focus. It's a challenge for all of us. David Grinspoon's most recent book, Earth in Human Hands, Shaping Our Planet's Future, should be in all of our hands. And David is a senior scientist at Planetary Science Institute and just a wonderful contributor to this program. When I can convince him to come on, keep coming on, David. We love having you.
Hey, thanks. I always love talking to you.
David Grinspoon and Adam Frank, the Helen F. and Fred H. Gowan Professor of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Rochester, author of numerous books including Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds, and The Fate of the Earth. Thank you, sir.
Great pleasure, as always.
And from the whole team at Connections, Emma Ray, Rob, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson, saying thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.